It's just that way, isn't it? Sometimes I feel so ineffably, completely, thoroughly, and uncontrollably evil that there's just no hope, no salvation anywhere. Ineffably rotten. Well, of course, this is an old thing. Man either feels implacably good, or quite the reverse, and actually is in between. In fact, not only is not in between, he is neither. It's difficult to know whether rocks are good or whether trees are bad, or whether brooks have sensitivity, or whether any of them in the long run are any different from any of us. You know, it's very rare when a very subtle point appears in a newspaper, a daily newspaper, a subtle point that has little to do with politics, that has nothing to do with show business, or an actual incident of the time, for example, the Algerian crisis or whatever it might be. And a couple of days ago, I came across an article in the Times, and I believe me, I hold no brief for the Times. I do not have a commercial for them, except to say that one of the most fascinating aspects of the Times, particularly on the Sunday edition side, is this strange series of articles that will come out, just appear, and usually under a byline that means very little to most people, in fact means very little to me, but it says something that is rarely discussed. This is the sort of thing that will rarely even appear in a magazine for some reason or other, and perhaps is one of the reasons why a newspaper can be a very valuable record of a time to bring things in a way back into focus, things that are often not treated with the degree of objectivity that they should be. For example, fiction. You know, you read the book review section of any newspaper, and book reviews in general, and you wonder whether or not any of the people who write, and the people who read writing, and the people who comment on writing, ever actually really look, or are a part of the world they write about. You know, it's interesting, because I've found most of the people who write in my acquaintanceship, the people I've known in my past who have written, and have written successfully, are people who generally withdraw from life a good part of the time. And I don't mean just to run out and look at the world and run back in and write. This is not what I mean. They started out at the age of 12 feeling alienated from their fellows. And as time went on, they became writers and remained in isolation comparatively from those around them. Now, I think the reason that most people can identify with these writers is not because they create characters that are real and situations that are real and come away with conclusions that are real, but because they do the opposite. Literally do the opposite. I think most of us are searching for a kind of, and I don't want to use the word ideal, because that isn't, we're searching for easy answers, and often this is what fiction gives us. For example, there's a current school of fiction which holds that the reader and the hero, or the character that runs through the book, is an excessively sensitive, good person who is aware of the phoniness and the rottenness of the whole world, which is the world outside, the bad world. I'm the good world. This is, in a sense, the Holden Caulfield syndrome. Now, I don't know whether this is true or not. In fact, I have not found it to be true in my life. I have found that if just once, at any one given point, through one of these books, the Holden Caulfield symbol suddenly turns around and he becomes a slob for a chapter and a half, quite obviously to the reader, then I suspect the whole spell would be broken. And it would be difficult, you see, because then it would be more like real life. It would be more of the ambiguity of actual existence. And for that reason, it would be very disturbing. Now, on a much more a calm level, or let's say more normal level of activity rather than fiction, let's say the daily give and take of politics or news or stuff in the office, you'll find the same thing too. There's the acceptance of a black and white. Everyone wants a black and white, and so everyone is hungering for somebody to get up and say, "Blow up the Russians," or let's do the opposite. If you'll notice, most of the slogans of the other side say such things as rather alive than dead, or dead than alive, or red than dead, or something like that. But the point is, they make a black and white. There's no in between at all. So it seems to be that everybody's looking for this. Barry Goldwater, for example, recently wrote a book in which all the answers are just there. Bang, 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 that's it. And then we go back and we become part of the 18th century again. It's no problem to do that. Just do it. This is great. It's like the continual how to raise yourself above your miserable level books that you constantly see on the newsstands. Then they sell by the millions, you know. 10 golden rules, 17 golden pass keys to eternal happiness. You read the book and you'll get there. And then you can also find it on the physical level. A new 30-day magic instant diet, which does not require any problems on your side. You don't have to have any effort, no exercise, nothing. And you'll lose weight and you'll be beautiful and happy forever, and you'll get your husband back. And your kids will love you. And then you'll suddenly start winning at bridge. And, you know, you'll start thinking right. And you won't have any of those terrible things that bug you. The terrible things that make you eat Triscuits all night long. No one discusses that part of it. Well, anyway, this article came out, and it's a pretty interesting article. It was written by a guy named Russell Baker. I don't know who Baker is. I presume he's a Washington Times correspondent in Washington, and apparently doesn't often get bylines, because I don't know the name. Do you know it, Russell Baker? But listen what he writes. It's a great newspaper column. It's datelined April 27th, Washington. I'm using this without permission of the Times. I hope they don't mind. Here it goes. Along Washington's quiet residential streets, these sweet spring evenings, there is a new night sound to vie with the mating call of the prothonotary warbler. It is the clack of the typewriter, drifting through the open window as the citizenry toils to convert its experiences of the day into fiction, preferably a best-selling novel. True, not everybody in town has written, is writing, or appears thinly disguised in a Washington novel, but with the rising flow from the publishers' presses, it is beginning to seem like it. The fad began with the success of Alan Drury's Advise and Consent, published in 1959. Since then, the parade of fictional presidents, vice presidents, cabinet officers, senators, congressmen, hostesses, ambassadors, pundits, government girls, and men and women on the make has reached flood tide. The amount of fiction involved is often just enough to earn the author safe passage around the libel laws. In disguises thinner than a Chicago stripteaser's work clothes, Washington's gaudiest personalities are trotted through the plots and made to speak and act with casual abandon. Among those who have been easily identifiable in recent appearances between hardcovers have been former presidents Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Vice Presidents Johnson, Richard Nixon. The late John Foster Dulles and John Kennedy appeared as a senator pining for the presidency. But it is not only the great who are apt to discover themselves exposed under fictional pseudonyms. One recent novel filled in several details not commonly known previously about the marital troubles of an easily identifiable newspaper reporter in Washington. Occasionally, whole situations are lifted verbatim from history. The hilarious 1955 fish flap in which President Eisenhower was enraged by news reports that he had caught more than the legal limit of Colorado trout is faithfully recreated by Andrew Tully in his book Capitol Hill. A Gift for Gamala by John Baxter spoofs the State Department. The Peacemakers by Marquis Childs takes a somber look at diplomacy in high places. A Bomb in the Attic by John Hay burlesques the morality of the town. And a forthcoming novel, etc., etc., etc. Anyway, here's where he gets into his point here. And this is where I think he really starts hitting pay dirt. Entertainment and literary values aside, what is absorbing about most of these novels is the sociological picture they paint of the world's most turbulent capital in turbulent times. The liquor consumption, for example, is depicted as something fierce, and the extra connubial capers of aging gentlemen charged with keeping the Russians at bay is frequently scandalous. Home life is usually drab. Wives are either pushing conscience-stricken husbands to get ahead by hook or crook, scolding them, or pushing them with excessive ruthlessness. No in between. The children are invariably a drag. Dad is always complaining because government keeps him away from them all the time, and then when he finally gets a free evening, he finds they bore them. The White House is the center of all mischief, either because the president cannot stay on top of his job or because he will stop at nothing to work his will. Presidents, however, whether inept or cunning, have only the country's good at heart. Other politicians come in only two varieties, those who will stop at nothing and good sports. Bureaucrats are almost invariably unprincipled devils who will do anything for self-promotion, invariably. Women have a decidedly bleak life in these novels. Those fortunate enough to be married see little of their famous husbands, and the bachelor girl rarely makes it to the altar, but does a lot of swinging. The newspapermen, on balance, are simple louts without home or family. Everyone, male, female, great, and menial, lives under the faintly depressing suspicion that the Russians are somehow vaguely winning, whatever the game is. Parties, which go on endlessly, are a constant round of tedium and are always presented as no fun at all in these books. No one ever mows the lawn, takes his wife to a movie, drives out to Great Falls, leans down to smell a rose, or puts up a mother-in-law visiting from Idaho and demanding to be taken on a tour of the FBI. Strangest of all, everybody is available on the telephone all the time, at all times. Hundreds of telephone calls are placed and promptly answered, with practically never an apology that the great man is in conference. It is conceivable that the novelists are painting the portrait of mid-century Washington that will survive. This is the interesting thing about it. It will color future generations' thinking about the place, just as the 19th century novelist did for London and the French impressionist for Paris. Do you really believe that London was the way Charles Dickens said it was? You see, we insist on, speaking of fiction, this is WOR New York, which is, of course, I'm using it in the cosmic sense. It really is WOR New York, but there's something that you have to reach, you know. There's shadows behind shadows. But this is interesting, you know. And he says, if so, there are, and his conclusion, you know, it's a strange newspaper article. It isn't the kind you usually find bracketed with do-it-yourself Danish furniture ads. It says, if so, there are going to be a lot of misconceptions for the historians to contend with, particularly about the usefulness of the telephone. Well, now, that's happening all around us. Now, he just happens to take Washington. Now, we have our own literary, our own literary values that appear in family life situations. For example, there is what has been termed the William Inge syndrome, where, and this runs through almost every novel that's written today, the angry type novel. First of all, fathers come in only two kinds. They are either beaten, wonderful old alcoholic types with a streak of poetry running through them, or they are brow-beating braggarts who bowl and yell and want their kid to score the touchdown for Yale. Now, that's the only two types of fathers there are. Can you think of any other types, really, that are important in novels? Now, then there are two types of mothers. There is the shrew, angry shrew type, who has destroyed the father and is on her way to destroying her daughter. Now, that type always has a daughter, never a son. She has a daughter. Now, there's that angry shrew type, or there is the wonderful, soft, vaguely fuzzy, beaten type who has taken to secret nipping in the basement, or she has become a dope addict because of the terrible driving bully of the husband she has. This one creeps to her daughter at night, or her son, usually her son, and quietly gives him her blessings. knowing full well that the father will kill her if he finds her at it. Okay, those are the two types of mothers. There's only two types. Now, the daughter of this, in this wonderful little family myth, is always a very sensitive person. And she is not only terribly sensitive, but she is being beaten to death by either the father or the mother, or both of them in concert. This is the Splendor in the Grass syndrome. And the man she meets is invariably so much more sensitive than any of the people around him. And he's usually very, very effeminate, too, in a lot of ways. But he's extremely sensitive and poetic. And the romance is almost always between people who are roughly 19. This is the only group of people who are capable of romance in American family fiction today. And anybody else, and interestingly enough, any male who is frankly male, is usually presented as the heavy, and or if he is the heavy, he is always so heavy as to be almost ludicrous. Do you remember the Splendor in the Grass? Do you remember the kid that was taking out the girl? Well, he looked like he had a false face on. He was so wildly improbable. Well, now these things are nevertheless called reality. Now, I wonder who calls them reality. They're really called realistic writing. Now, if these things were called fictions, if these were just merely called fantasies about family life, you know, it'd be fine. But they're presented as genuine people. This is the way it really is. Now, it's intriguing that I have never yet found in my existence, of course, I have no more right to say it than Inge, I suppose, or less. And it seems to me that it never is as clean cut as that. Maybe we desire to be these people. Maybe that's what it is. I guess it's the word realism that bothers most people who read this and then look around in their lives, you know, and look around at the people around them, who see that perhaps, are you really sensitive? And that's what I'd like to ask you. Are you really Holden Caulfield? Or did Holden Caulfield create you? Were you Holden Caulfield before you read Salinger? Or were you Zooey before you read it? Or did you become that afterwards? And another question, too. Are you really that loving? Are you really that sensitive? If so, show me. It's very difficult to show it. It's the thing of constantly being told that somebody is loving or has great understanding, and never once is it demonstrated. It's the way often you'll find a writer portrayed on stage, and then when you read some of his writing, it usually turns out to be pretty rotten, the writing that he has written, when it's quoted. An example of that currently is on Broadway in No Strings, when the Pulitzer Prize winning author, when his work is trotted out, it's pretty bad. And so you can't. Where does it stop? And I would never, another thing too, I noticed that whenever people, all the way down the line it fits, whenever a guy in Madison Avenue man, for example, is shown in a movie or a play or a book, he is a specific type. And interestingly enough, a type that I myself have never observed on Madison Avenue. When a salesman is portrayed of any type, he is invariably portrayed as a hard-driving, sort of secretly sick, defeated, inside Willie Loman. But outside, he's, come on, let's go, boys, we're going to put it over the top. Do you know we don't have a single salesman here at WOR who even remotely fits that pattern? Remotely. As a matter of fact, they're usually quite the opposite of what the public image of these things are. And then when television people are presented, TV people, actors, performers, they're always presented as a certain kind. They have a front face which they give to the public, which is glib and sharp and funny and loving and wonderful. And then there's the other side, which are rotten, driving, terrible. And there's a great word, you know, that starts with a B. This is what they all are. on the other side. And yet, you know, it's very disillusioning to find that they're almost invariably really what they are on camera. Haven't you found that to be pretty true? I mean, people here in the business, it's a little discouraging to find out. You wish you could find this guy who's real nervous off camera. You know, oh, he's nervous, he's worried. No, Jack Parr, you're going to be discouraged to find out, was exactly off camera as he was on. In every little contact I ever had with him. And so was Arthur Godfrey. Even though he was always presented to be something totally different off camera. You know, this, as soon as the mic goes off, he gets out the bullwhip and starts, you know, whipping it around at people, and the jugs come out, and the next thing you know, it's never like that. I wish it were that way. And so, in the end, you begin to wonder where all this fiction comes from, whether or not it's what is this hungry urge, is this thing within us that wants us to believe that all politicians are dishonest. This is one of the things that we believe. This is almost an article of faith, that all politicians are dishonest. Ask anybody, they'll tell you that this is true. Well, is it? I wonder. I'm curious. I don't know. Now, I can only say that if you write one, either they're dishonest or they're fantastically, almost maniacally ambitious. And because they are so ambitious, that leads to dishonesty. Chicanery of one kind or another. I just wonder whether it's true or not. Funny thing, you know, I've known several executives, for example, in the radio industry. Now, this radio and television industry is supposed to be filled with hard-driving, fanatical guys. And this is no apologia for this business. I'm telling you, it's one of the most ridiculous businesses you can get into. And yet, so many of the executives I know are mild, meek little characters who, by a series of circumstances, were just shoved into the job they got. One thing and another, and the next thing you know, they're there, you know? Now, of course, they're ambitious, but then who isn't? Most everybody is. I just wonder about this. I'm curious. I'm curious how many fathers, now I know that there's a lot of people listening to me who are young people, you know, who are college or even younger than that, or high school age. Are you really sure that your father is the clod you think he is? Are you really sure of that? Are you really sure that he totally does not understand you? You know, are you really sure of that? On the other hand, are you really sure that you're the wonderful thing you think you are? That you're so sensitive and you have such great insight into things, and you are so good. That's in capital letters. That most of the world does not understand you. Are you really sure you're that good? Or is your sensitivity more or less a kind of, again, part of the cult of the ego, which is growing to be such a tremendous force in American life? Speaking of forces in American life, we have a note here from TV Guide. And they say there's no substitute for TV Guide. They just say it right out flat. I mean, it's a TV Guide is here. It's accurate, authentic. And it's ready to go. And do you have a little thing in there for us? You don't have one of these things? You do? All right, good. This is a loud one.
Today and tomorrow, it's Alcoa, Alcoa, the name that means aluminum.
Be a carefree family this summer with a new chain link fence of Alcoa aluminum. Imagine the peace of mind that comes from knowing where your children are all the time. And watch your flowers, shrubs, and young trees flourish when an aluminum fence goes up. They're protected, too. And remember, aluminum fencing just naturally stays bright and beautiful. No red rust, no painting, no tiresome maintenance ever. Protect your property and your family with a new chain-link fence made of Alcoa aluminum.
These guys got the chain-link fences at Corvettes. That's a scary phrase, chain link fence. It sounds like something that should be electrified. You know, with little barbs sticking out of the top. Do you ever see an electrified fence? Do you ever work behind one? With a big thing going around the top? big signs that say, danger, this fence is electrified. With searchlights on it, like in the movies. This once happened to me. It was in the army. I couldn't believe it. It really was the way they showed it. You know, guards walking around with sawed-off shotguns. It says, this fence is electrified. Do not come within 20 feet of it. Stay beyond the yellow line. And once in a while, on dark nights, when the rain was coming down, you could hear the fence humming. It really was electrified. And you know, you have a terrible desire to go out and touch it, like you do with a fence that's just been painted. It says 40,000 volts, stay away. And you want to go over and stick your, boom, ionized. Some night I'll tell you about what that was about, a strange time. Speaking of commercials, we have also with us tonight the Village Voice. One of our old people has returned. And it's a funny thing about the Voice. It's become such a force here in America that there really isn't very much you can say about it. I can tell you this, that after having read The Voice and having been involved with it for, since about 1955, thereabouts, when I first got involved with the people, that I still find The Voice every week to be the most interesting reading that I get every week. And The Voice, just like everything else, has its great weeks and it has its nothing weeks. But I think that in itself is a virtue, because it sometimes goes so great and sometimes is so terrible that you have always a sense of never knowing what's going to happen. And I think one of the great things about The Voice is that it has always maintained this. However, one thing I do wish to mention, perhaps you are not aware, but recently the Doubleday Publishing Company compiled a great collection of what they considered to be the best of what appeared in The Village Voice in the first 5 years of its publication. And it is a fascinating piece of reading. I'll tell you this, I believe that in 25 to 30 years, this Village Voice reader is going to be studied by a lot of historians and a lot of sociologists particularly as a record of one kind of thinking, or at least one phase of America, which gets very little voice in the world. And I think in the end it'll probably be the most important voice, or certainly most important voices. I'm not saying the Village Voice itself will be, but it's just this whole strange underground growing up through the grass ferment that is evident everywhere in America. And I think one of the first places that ever got a real genuinely popular voice is in the Village Voice. And if you're curious about this and you don't know anything about the Village Voice, I would suggest that in your local bookstore, wherever it might be, you ask to see a copy of the Village Voice Reader. There's all kinds of strange people in it, and great people, a very peculiar mixed bag, ranging all the way from Steve Allen and Nat Hentoff and Jules Pfeiffer, Shel Silverstein. All kinds of interesting people are in this book, but it is a compilation of a whole series of things through the years, and you will find, as you read it, it's like reading an underground history of the past 5 years. For example, one of the great pieces in there is a discussion, is a reporting of the Mike Todd, Elizabeth Taylor party over here at Madison Square Garden. And it's one of the best accounts of that whole thing. And I think 20 years from now, this is liable to be reprinted in 1,000 different volumes as an example of the wild time that was lived by the people in America in the 1950s. I think it's going to be an important book. And you will find it around on bookshelves every place. It's called The Village Voice Reader, and it was published by Doubleday. And you can order it from The Village Voice itself for just $2.50. And for $2.50, it's a great amount of reading. You just send a card to Village Voice, W-O-R, and just put on it Reader, and they'll bill you. And by the way, if you would like to subscribe to The Village Voice, you do it the same way. Just send a postcard to Village Voice, W-O-R, New York, New York. And no matter where you are in the country, you'll find this an interesting paper. I personally guarantee it. And I'll tell you this, if you don't like the paper, you just write them right back right away and say, cut it out, forget it, and they that's the end of it. They will not pursue it any further. But I know you'll enjoy it. It's a wild, interesting paper. And one more thing I want to say about it to show you the kind of people they've developed. Jerry Tomer, the Village Voice drama critic, who is a fascinating critic, I think, You may disagree with Jerry about 3 times out of 4, but you cannot help but be stirred by him. He really tees you off. Just recently won the George Jean Nathan Critics Award, which is the highest, one of the very highest awards given to theater critics in America. And, of course, he works exclusively in The Voice. I think you'll find it worth reading. And it's $4 a year. It's a weekly. And it's delivered all over the world now. It's one of the truly international newspapers published anywhere in the world. You know, you can walk down Fleet Street in London. And if you have Village Voice credentials, it's interesting. Village Voice credentials will let you in anywhere, in Paris and in London. And most of the papers throughout the United States are totally unknown there. But The Voice is not only known, but highly respected. If you want to subscribe, and I would recommend it, just drop a card to Village Voice, W-O-R, New York, New York. And they'll bill you, and that's all there is to it. No problems. You know, getting back to this business of fiction, as how it's going to affect historians' attitudes towards the world that fiction itself is reporting on. That's, you see, because history, actual history, only reports events usually. In other words, if you're writing a history of, say, World War II, you write a history of the events that occurred in World War II, and you record the names of the people who took part in them, who the generals and this type of person, this one was running that particular theater and so on. But you do not necessarily, and never, I rarely see history that goes beyond that. What kind of people were they? How did they think? How did they feel about it? What was their attitude? Now, I can tell you this, the people who were in World War II, the attitude towards the war, and I'm just talking as an ex-GI, and I know that the millions of GIs who were there during the war, would be very, very hard-pressed to identify their attitudes if they're honest about it, if they genuinely look back and say, what did I really think about the war? With the fiction that came out and is still coming out about the war. I know that reading novels about World War II, I find it difficult to say, well, yes, I thought this way. The action, yeah, you can't argue with. The action is there. Everyone knows what an M4 tank is like. Everyone knows what the Garand or the M1 was like. Everyone knows what the Battle of Bastogne was like. But the point is, when they begin to talk about the kind of people that were there and the attitudes and the situations that developed out of their attitudes, I wonder whether they were really there or not. And I'm curious about whether 100 years from now, when people read these pieces of fiction and they say, well, now this is the way these people were. I'm just curious whether it'll be true or not. I wonder whether fiction ever can really do that. Or whether you can ever really do it in any form at all and get away with it. For example, there is a famous writer who writes about ancient Grecian themes. And I've read her writing. It's a woman. I've read her writing. And she not only writes about the place, she writes about the artifacts, and she writes about the social structure of the time, but she also puts words into the mouths of the people and emotions into their heads and so forth, and she's considered to be a great delineator of that period. I'm curious. I'm very curious. How can a person, how can you really understand the thinking of somebody who lived 4,000 years ago? And you're going to say, people are always people, forget it. They're not. I will not accept that old clinker. I don't believe it. I have found people in many, many places in the world who think so differently from the way you think and the way I think that in the end, you could never put words in their mouth. You could never attempt to say, well, now he's thinking so-and-so. He is thinking that. And I'll tell you this, 500,000 GIs who went out into the South Pacific during World War II know this. That the Japanese thought in a completely different way from the way we think. Now, you can give me 1,000 reasons why this is so, but the fact is that it was so. And I know, here, I have a friend of mine. Now, here's where you run into difficulty of this kind of identification of types and oversimplification. I guess what I'm saying is that fiction has a tendency to not only oversimplify, but it creates the image that it purports to report on. In other words, 18 million Holden Caulfields developed after the book was written. You know? When Kerouac wrote On the Road, suddenly 47,000 guys began to feel that they were Dean Moriarty. And they began to act like Dean Moriarty. You see, whether they were there before or not is beside the point. I'm curious about this. But anyway, the thing that I'm curious about in connection with this this business of fiction, and particularly related to times and areas of time, it is generally conceded that Dickens, Charles Dickens, created an image of Victorian England that has never yet really left the mind of people. They always imagine the Pickwick Club, and they imagine the whole crew, you know, old Sam Weller and the whole crowd, and they really are real, you know. To them, that's a typical type of Englishman of the time. I'm very curious whether this is so or not. Mark Twain is another example. I read Mark Twain. I'm sitting out in Nigeria reading Mark Twain, and he's writing about the Midwest, and he's going along about this, and he's writing about the South and the river and the whole business, and I'm curious whether or not he was relating. Maybe he was creating. Now, certainly when he wrote about the place, when he discussed the physical aspects of there was a magnificent description of a Midwestern home in Life on the Mississippi. Some night I'm going to bring it in and read it to you. It's such a beautiful description of a typical home, the kind of artwork, the attitudes, and everything else in the home. But I'm curious whether or not the people reading it at the time would just laugh about it, and not necessarily this is the way it really is. Now, of course, there always has to be an element of truth in any masterpiece. There's got to be. There's no question about it. But I'm curious whether or not it's just an element of truth regarding a desire or a thought we've already got in our minds that has nothing to do with us. You can see, for example, take Hitler now. When Hitler rose to power, Hitler described the Germans to themselves as they never were. Are you aware of that? He told the Germans they were something they weren't, and millions of them bought it. And it seemed to them that this is the real way the Germans really are. Well, it was a pure fiction, but it wasn't really a fiction because they really desired to be that. And so, by desiring to be that, they believed they were that. Now, that's another kind of fiction. Now, you could say, was it real or not? I don't know. I wonder what they are. I wonder what everybody is, really. In the end, you know? And so, for 1,000 years. Now the fictional treatment, say, for example, of people like George Washington, I doubt very much today whether, George Washington is just a statue. He's so completely unreal to most of us. And even when you read the fictional accounts of George, perhaps it's because the fictional accounts of George Washington have affected people's minds. You know, there was a man who wrote a series of books on Washington for young people. What was his name? Oh, he was a real hack. And in the 18th century, right after Washington's death, when Washington, of course, was a big hero, like Eisenhower after World War II, he was a great national hero. And, of course, he'd been the first president. This man deliberately set out to write a series of books that would appeal to the public mind and the public imagination. And, in fact, I read a note that he had written to somebody saying, I have an idea about writing some books which I will sell. If you will publish them, I will go around the country and sell them. Well, one of the stories in his book was the story of George Washington chopping down the cherry tree, which he created totally out of his mind, his imagination, a whole series of fables. And yet, this book affected countless people in believing that Washington really was this way. Until finally, now people today will argue, they'll argue tooth and nail about the fact that Washington was this kind of person. And this man created it totally out of a fiction. Now, was it true or wasn't it true? Well, who knows? Whether or not the domineering father, How many people, put up, all raise your hands now. How many people are living under a completely domineering, bullying father? Raise your hands. Okay, now, all right. Now, we'll ask the other crowd now to raise your hands. How many of you are living under a vaguely defeated, wonderful, kind of poetic, slightly ineffectual father? Raise your hands. Okay. Are you sure he is one or the other? Now, you see, almost everybody raised his hand for one group or the other. Now, are you really sure about it? Is it as clean cut? Is it true that you are being destroyed by your parents, which is one of the popular fables of our time, too? Or were they destroyed by their parents, who in turn were destroyed by their parents? Who does it goes all the way back, you know? Has it ever occurred to you that your father might have been destroyed by his parents? And that his father, your grandfather, was destroyed by his parents? Until finally you get back into the jungle, you know? And everybody's destroying everybody else. And everybody who is at the point end, I think this is one of the probably most telling parts of fiction. Anyone who's at the point end of the pyramid, which means the current generation being anybody who is, I'd say, under 45, the current generation of operating people, all feel invariably that they are the ones that have been done in the most. Now, I suspect this is true of every generation, and always has been. They're the ones that have been done in the most. And it's going to be a terrible feeling suddenly to find another... what are we going to do when another generation comes after us and claims that we destroyed them? How are we going to handle that one? How are you going to explain to them how sensitive you are? And how loving you are? And how your name is Holden Caulfield inside? Or it's Eva Marie Saint? Or it's Julie Harris inside? And you're really a very, very... a very method performer. But in spite of that, how are we going to explain that to them? Will anyone believe? Does it matter?